I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, this election was supposed to be about war and the economy, but will the war be a domestic one between urban and rural America? But first, stocks around the world are rebounding with the news that the U.S. government is taking over troubled mortgage lenders Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, one of the biggest government rescues in American history. According to one Wall Street trader quoted this morning, the deal announced yesterday prevents an Armageddon. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are involved in about three-quarters of all new mortgages. If they sink, the struggling U.S. economy sinks further. But will saving them from drowning leave taxpayers on the hook for maybe up to $100 billion? What does all of this mean for the consumer? Well, joining us, Michael Crittenden, reporter for Dow Jones Newswires. And Michael, we hear on the one hand that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac got involved in too many mortgages as they tried to drive up their shareholders' stock, and that the government's going to force them to downsize. But we also hear that an infusion of government support will eventually lead to more loans. So which is true? How does this deal affect potential home buyers?
Well, for potential home buyers, this should be a net positive. The goal is to add some stability, some certainty in the U.S. housing market. Best way for the government to do that, and probably their only option, was to explicitly say, this is how we're going to shore up these two firms, which really are, you know, the one piston left in the economy that's been working. They've been the only game in town. If you want a mortgage, it's going to have to go through Fannie and Freddie at some point. So by doing this, it should stabilize, if not lower, interest rates for potential home buyers.
And what does this mean for people who already have mortgages and may be in over their heads? Will this deal in any way affect their ability to maybe renegotiate?
This specifically won't, but the program, the authority given to Treasury to do this was part of a larger piece of housing legislation passed earlier this year by Congress in July, signed by President Bush, that created a lot of different programs that are going online right now to help homeowners who may be in over their head. And people should just really be reaching out to their lenders, because lenders right now, they don't want homes to go in foreclosure either. It costs them a lot more than if they can rework a loan.
And what exactly is the government doing in its new relationship with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Is it infusing money?
Not exactly at first. What they're going to do, they're going to be buying mortgage-backed securities from the firms, probably about $5 billion worth this month. That's just to give the firms cash to continue to go about their business. Neither of these terms were on the verge of failing. It was more, there were so many questions surrounding their viability long-term that it was scaring investors around the world. So what this does, it sort of gives the government backing. Necessarily, they won't be injecting lots of capital. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson has said he doesn't want to immediately invest in them. But, you know, the government has taken a controlling stake. They are going to, you know, be controlling on a day-to-day basis, approving everything, and having a lot of say-so over what they're doing.
So the government is going to have an infusion of cash in that it's buying out some of these mortgages. Well, both these companies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, are not government institutions. They're just quasi-government institutions, and they also have shareholders. They are private companies in that way. So what about the shareholders? Who stands to lose there?
For shareholders, this is probably bad news in the short term, because it dilutes their holdings. I mean, the Treasury Department is taking a stake, and, you know, anytime they do that, it's going to dilute shareholders. And you can probably see from their stock prices today, they're falling a lot. Longer term, the hope is that this will stabilize the companies and get them back on solid footing, get the whole housing market back on solid footing, which eventually could earn both the U.S. Government and shareholders some money.
Is there a question as to whether or not these two companies should remain sort of quasi-government with both shareholders and government rescue?
That's the huge issue, and Secretary Paulson stressed that yesterday, that the next president, the next Congress, are going to have to do that. I was speaking with House Financial Services Chairman Barney Frank yesterday afternoon. He said this is something that he's planning on taking up in his committee. Senator Chris Dodd, chairman of the Banking Committee, made similar comments. This is something that the next administration, the next Congress, is going to have to wrestle with long-term. What is the role of government in housing? For a long time, government has encouraged home ownership, and housing, and it sort of begs the question what that role should be, how active, and whether or not the private market itself can take care of it.
Meanwhile, we're hearing that taxpayers may be on the hook for up to $100 billion when all is said and done, if mortgages continue to fail and these two companies need that much more help. $100 billion, where's that going to come from?
Well, it's actually a lot more than that. I mean, theoretically, if Treasury exercises all of its options, that's not going to happen. I mean, no one expects that. This, in the end, probably won't cost anything because over time, Treasury's investments, assuming they stabilize things and the cycle turns back and the housing market improves, then Treasury will actually earn money on its investments, and it won't cost taxpayers anything. So I think longer term, and that's how you have to look at it, I mean, an injection of $1 billion now in securities could down the road, those, you know, will probably gain. They can't go down too much farther at this point, considering.
Michael Crittenden, reporter for Dow Jones Newswires. Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
Before I became governor of the great state of Alaska, I was mayor of my hometown. And since our opponents in this presidential election seem to look down on that experience, let me explain to them what the job involves.
He worked as a community organizer. What? You see, Washington has been looking to the eastern elites, to the editorial pages of the Times and the Post, and to the broadcasters from the coast. If America really wants to change, it's time to look for the sun in the west, because it's about to rise and shine from Arizona and Alaska.
Have the Republicans, led by Sarah Palin, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, whom we just heard, and former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, launched a new culture war? Conservative editor Thomas Lifson as much as declared one, writing in The American Thinker that Sarah Palin exposes the depth of the cultural divide between middle America and the leftists who have taken over education, media, and the cultural establishment. The LA Times writes that speaker after speaker at last week's convention defended small towns from the perceived slights of the urban elites. But for many, those slights aren't perceived. They feel they're real, and they point to Barack Obama's comments in San Francisco early in the campaign about small-town Americans frustrated by job losses, clinging to guns and religion. Here's Sarah Palin's response last Wednesday.
I might add that in small towns, we don't quite know what to make of a candidate who lavishes praise on working people when they're listening, and then talks about how bitterly they cling to their religion and guns when those people aren't listening. We tend to prefer candidates who don't talk about us one way in Scranton and another way in San Francisco.
Culture wars was a phrase used by Pat Buchanan in a speech that defined the 1992 Republican convention.
There is a religious war going on in this country. It is a cultural war as critical to the kind of nation we shall be as the Cold War itself, but this war is for the soul of America.
But the phrase was first brought into the political lexicon by University of Virginia sociologist James Davidson Hunter, who today says culture wars are always below the surface. Palin's daughter's out-of-wedlock pregnancy just helped it bubble up. But left-leaning voters are saying they weren't the ones that made out-of-wedlock pregnancies a culture issue. The right did, and blamed it on loose liberal values. And while we're at it, community organizers are saying, what's wrong with us? Historian Rick Perlstein is a senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future. His new book is Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. And Rick, you take today's conversation at the Republican convention all the way back to Nixon's high school campaign. So tell us, you know, about that campaign and how you draw that line out from there.
It was actually in college.
Oh, college, okay.
And he was supposed to go to college at Harvard. He was the smartest kid in his class, and he won a scholarship. But
and you know what I'm thinking?
Afford...
I'm thinking high school because he was 17.
Right.
Yeah.
He was a brilliant kid. And he couldn't afford the train fare, basically, to get back and forth from Cambridge. So he had to go to this local school, Whittier. And what did he find? There's only one fraternity he wants to join. But they won't let him in the fraternity because he's not cool enough. The cool kids are called the Franklins, and they dress well, and they speak well, and they always seem to be looking down their noses at the rest of the students who seemed kind of resigned to their exclusion. So what did Richard Nixon do? This is really the template for his entire political career, and really became the template for the Republican appeal for the next generation or even two generations. He started a club called the Orthogonians that was for the kids who couldn't get into the Franklins, the kids who felt looked down upon, just like Sarah Palin in her speech said that the people in the Democratic Party, the liberals, the elites, are looking down their noses at you. And lo and behold, it proved to be a brilliant political move because the people who feel looked down upon are a lot more prevalent than the cool kids. Richard Nixon, you know, won student body president in college, and he kind of ran the same campaign ever since, 52, 68, 72. Even when he was kind of campaigning towards the end of his life for respect as an elder statesman, this idea that they're looking down their noses at me because I'm just an ordinary person, and you're an ordinary person too, so who they're really looking down their noses at is you, was central to how he did politics and very influential.
Well, and it got carried on by Spiro Agnew, a vice president who spoke of the nattering nabobs. I can't remember which way it was said.
Nattering nabobs of negativism.
And it carried to vilifying the press, that the press also took on this role of looking down its nose at rural folks.
They were an unelected elite. This idea that they didn't understand how real Americans really lived. They were stuck there in, you know, Washington and New York. You know, one of the sub rosa implications that some people got from it is that they were not always Christian. And the idea that they could tell the rest of us how to live, how to think, and not think twice about it proved to be a very potent political appeal for the Republicans.
Well, Rick, you are a much admired historian on the left and the right. William Buckley was one of the biggest fans of your biography of
Barry Goldwater.
Barry Goldwater, thank you. But you do write from the left. During the week, we're going to hear a voice from the right, Dr. Richard Land, president of the Southern Baptist Convention Ethics and Religious Liberties Commission. We're going to take a break in a minute and a half. I want you to respond, though, to his claim that people on the left have to flip their perspective to see how people on the right do feel demeaned, for instance, in contemporary times, when they're put down for not accepting gay marriage. Rick?
Oh, I thought you were going to play a tape. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I mean, basically, all American politics is populist politics, the people who say that they're speaking for the ordinary people against the elite. And when the agenda is these kinds of cultural issues, it tends to favor the Republicans. When the agenda is the economic issues, it tends to favor the Democrats. I have a group of conservatives who I email with all the time, and they consider the Palin nomination a great triumph. They see liberals falling right into their trap by laughing at her. And but the same person, when I said, you know, well, economic issues might be important, what about the bankruptcy bill? What about the fact that people are really hurting? Laughed at me for thinking that bankruptcy was a serious issue that had a big constituency in America. So there's patronization going all around. But on the left, it tends to come from cosmopolitan perspective, and from the right, it tends to come from a cultural perspective.
That's Rick Perlstein, senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future, author of Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America, and how it continues today. We'll continue our conversation in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more from historian Rick Perlstein, a senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future. His new book is Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. And it also could have another subtitle, you know, The Beginning of Culture Wars in America. And Rick, we were talking about bringing this all up to today, talking about, of course, the Republican convention last week, analysts on the left and right saying that a new culture war has been declared and having some questions about it. We spoke to Kansas Senator Brownback last week, who said, well, it could be a slippery slope if this heated rhetoric continues. But we're wondering what you think liberals maybe or the left has learned maybe from the last cultural war. We searched through all the major speeches from the Democratic Convention, Obama, Biden, both Clintons, and found only one possible put down. It was from Bill Clinton recounting how people he'd met didn't have health care, and Clinton then said, are these the family values the Republicans are so proud of? Otherwise, there wasn't one you know, sort of us-them kind of put-down.
Yeah, I mean, let me give you an example of how liberals tended to respond to kind of culture war tropes of a previous generation. When Richard Nixon chose this obscure guy, Spiro Agnew, a figure in a lot of ways much like Sarah Palin, as his vice president, Hubert Humphrey ran a television commercial that started with audio of a man laughing hysterically, and the screen pulled away, and you saw what he was laughing at. It was the name Spiro Agnew on a TV screen. Liberals have really been thinking hard and working hard about, achieving this kind of empathy with people who might find that the movements for social justice are disruptive of their deep-seated traditions. And you won't see that kind of laughter anymore. You see, obviously, that kind of laughter among the Republicans. They laughed at us. They laughed at the community organizers. And what I see, actually, politically, is a long-term structural change in which laterally it's become the Republicans and the conservatives who've kind of lost the ability to speak to a broad swath of Americans. They've spoken to themselves for so long that they can use this very cutting rhetoric, as Senator Brownback pointed out, and not even hear it as cutting rhetoric. They can hear it as kind of universalizing rhetoric. And I think in a lot of ways that the tables have turned such that the Republicans are the arrogant and contemptuous ones, and the liberals are doing a lot better job of being open-minded.
Well, and you might characterize it as arrogant and contemptuous, but Americans are loving it. They think Sarah Palin is speaking to them. She's completely rejuvenated John McCain's campaign. I want to ask you, though, about how maybe unlike the 60s or even the 50s, there's been sort of an unusual trading of sides in some of the debates. Mm-hmm. Many of the voices asking, for instance, if Sarah Palin can be both a mom of five and a VP would call themselves feminists. I mean, Sally Quinn of The Washington Post has joined Dr. Laura, the conservative talk show host, in questioning if a mother of young children can be VP. And here in Boston, there's a radio host on a station called WRKO, Reese Hopkins. He was talking about Sarah Palin's daughter's out-of-wedlock pregnancy and was flooded with angry emails from listeners who told him that's strictly a family issue. He went back into his email box and discovered that at least 70 of those emails were from the very same people who had written a few months earlier excoriating the teenagers who were pregnant in the fishing village of Gloucester. Our listeners remember that story. As he said to them on the air, you called those girls sluts and said their parents were horrible.
Right. And to a lot of liberals, this kind of thing is very baffling. But it makes a lot more sense if you see politics as a war for civilizational stakes between kind of two tribes, you know, the kind of normal Americans speaking in the Nixon-Reagan vein and these kind of cosmopolitan elites who are going to destroy our birthright. Such that that kind of ends justify the means, kind of what we would call hypocrisy, seems reasonable because they're fighting for civilizational stakes. So he's on our team, is John McCain, who, of course, was excoriated by a lot of conservatives last year. She's on
last
our
week,
team.
Last week, week before last.
Yeah, and we have to close ranks because this is our team, and we are fighting against liberals who are going to destroy our way of life, and that may require some kind of tactical compromises. But in the end, it's basically Pat Buchanan, actually, who was a staffer for Richard Nixon. He put it this way: "Look, he said the point is to divide the country in half and then end up with the bigger half." So you aren't making these fine distinctions once the battle lines are drawn, once you're going into battle against the liberals.
Well, and again, if you're just tuning in, we're going to have Dr. Richard Land, who's president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberties Commission, who says that the left still is looking at the right through a prism of arrogance and an urbane lifestyle that doesn't understand some
right.
of rural America.
I think that's very tactical on his part. For example, I've heard him give speeches in which he says, you know, that pro-life people are not welcome in the Democratic Party. Now, of course, that's a lie. I mean, the majority leader of the Senate, Harry Reid, is pro-life. So they're just trying to kind of continue this polarizing rhetoric because it's been so effective. And my suspicion is that it's becoming kind of less and less reflective of the reality on the ground. And that's what I mean when I say the Republicans and the conservatives are not as good as they used to be in kind of speaking to the broad swaths of America. The way that they think that everyone already must think like them, so they can kind of take charge of the rhetoric in ways that might not signify for people's actual lives on the ground.
And we do, I do want to point out, though, that last week when Phyllis Schlafly, speaking on her sister show, On Point, they were talking about Sarah Palin's choice to have a child knowing it would be born with Down syndrome. She said if Sarah Palin was a Democrat, she would have aborted that child. Reverend Land said he was appalled by that comment. Hmm. And so at least he has said that also in public. Rick Perlstein, a senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future, author of Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. Do you think the dialogue is going to be going back soon to the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, the economy, Sarah Palin's achievements as a mayor or governor? I mean, we're certainly going to try to do that, but do you think the national dialogue will go there?
Not if the Republicans can help it. Basically, what we see going on until November is a war to define the terrain of the election. The Republicans will try and make it a culture war, and the Democrats will try and make it a referendum on the last 8 years and the economy and the war. And whoever succeeds is the better politician.
Rick Perlstein, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, tomorrow, what do gay marriage, bilingual education, hunting, and pregnant pigs have in common? They're going to be on the ballots in November. We'll take a look at voter-initiated questions and referendums. That's tomorrow. Back after the news, here and now. It's not something we think much about, but today's always-on, always-connected lifestyle is built on rechargeable lithium-ion batteries. They're in laptop computers, cell phones, iPods. Boy, do they have problems, like flameouts, early failures, and capacity limitations that force traveling computer users to fight for airport power outlets. If someone came up with a better, safer, longer-lasting lithium-ion battery, he or she would be a superhero. Well, Christina Lampe-Anarud may be just that person. IEEE Spectrum Radio's Tekla Perry has our profile of this 40-year-old research chemist, jazz singer, and soccer mom.
Whether leading children in song at a backyard picnic or revolutionizing the high-voltage battery industry, Christina Lampe-Anarud is a take-charge kind of woman, and her timing can be prescient.
I think we must make a rocket for the summer. Let's go! Rocket for the summer!
In the late 1990s, there was so much energy jammed into typical lithium-ion laptop batteries, they were getting dangerously close to packing as much power as hand grenades. And that got Lampe-Anarud, then a consultant for the Cambridge, Massachusetts-based research firm Arthur D. Little, more than a bit nervous. In 1999, she told industry leaders attending the 40th Battery Symposium in Kyoto, Japan, that trouble was coming. But they shrugged off her warnings.
And I remember how people really did not appreciate the notion of not just running on capacity as the sole indicator for measuring success or performance, but actually introducing a more complex structure of saying safety actually matters, rate capability actually matters, and at the time feeling rather dismissed.
3 years later, bad things indeed started to happen. Laptop batteries started failing, and no one could quite figure out why. So Lampe-Anarud decided to stop talking about the problems and start finding solutions. She quit her job and started her own company, Boston Power, in a carriage house at her home in Framingham, Massachusetts.
Last day at work is Halloween for me. So I come home, we go out trick-or-treating in the streets, we get way too much candy, and on November 1, I step up the floors to our second floor, go into the study, and close the door, open the home computer, which is blank, and I get hooked.
Lampe-Anarud spent the next 2 months figuring out how to make a better battery. And she came up with an idea, a big idea, that like many big ideas, seems obvious after the fact. A laptop's battery slot, she reckoned, determines the size of the battery you can fit into it, but it doesn't stop you from reorganizing what's inside the battery itself. And just as a simple kitchen remodel can make a family's life more efficient, Lampe-Anarud designed a more powerful, longer-lasting, and safer power pack by tinkering with the battery's innards.
Instead of having two cells in parallel, one could design a big cell so everything is in series, because lots of the problems stem from the fact that if the two cells become unbalanced with respect to either impedance or temperature or maybe manufacturing, small manufacturing differences, the whole pack basically suffers. And today that seems so simple, but it wasn't. That's probably the simplest innovation and maybe the most important.
Meanwhile, problems with existing lithium-ion batteries began hitting the news. In June 2006, that infamous Dell laptop caught fire during a conference in Osaka, Japan. Then Sony recalled 10 million batteries, others followed. More recently, an iPod burst into flames in the back pocket of an Atlanta airport employee, and journalists in Korea watched a colleague's laptop flame out. And venture capitalists, who had already expressed some interest in Lampiana Rudd's work, were pounding on her door.
I am not a person who takes joy in people's misery, frankly. I think it's a problem for the industry. I think it's a problem for people. The battery industry as a whole still has very, very low failure rate. But of course, if you are the person that sits in front of a computer and your computer all of a sudden starts hissing and you see flames shooting out, it's pretty dramatic to you.
Lampiana Rudd quickly lined up funding from three venture capital firms. Other investors followed, and so far she's attracted $68 million, hired more than 40 people, and her first generation of batteries, the Sonatas, are rolling off assembly lines in China and Taiwan. This year, Lampiana Rudd's company, Boston Power, will produce about 1 million batteries a month. And at least three major laptop manufacturers are getting ready to ship products containing her Sonata batteries. It's an intense time for Lampiana Rudd.
Okay, good morning, everybody, and welcome.
Her days are filled with meetings, and her evenings are devoted to her family, except, that is, for Thursdays.
Oh, what a day, what a happy, happy day. Oh, what a day, what a happy, happy day.
Music has always been a big part of Lampiana Rudd's life. And she continues that passion today, directing a woman's a cappella group called the Stardust Show Chorus.
What a day, what a day, what a day.
Lampiana Rudd's long days are a walking advertisement for her Sonata battery. After a year of hard use, a traditional lithium-ion battery loses half its power capacity. That, she says, doesn't happen with her Sonatas.
I now run my laptop on a Sonata pack, which is a year and a half or maybe even 2 years old. And I charge it overnight and I run my entire day on this laptop. So I would say it has truly changed the way I work. Whereas before I would have a new pack, be totally excited, and after 2 months be totally frustrated, I actually don't think about the battery. I take some joy in that we are able to bring down the frustration of the end user. You actually can, for the first time, get a battery that delivers what has been promised in the marketing material.
Is Christina Lampiana Rudd the superhero who will revolutionize the battery industry? Well, we'll see. In the meantime, she hopes the choices she made to make her product environmentally friendly and to emphasize safety and longevity instead of sheer power will set a new path for the industry. If that happens, Lampiana Rudd will call her venture a success. And after that, she says,
oh, I don't know. I think there are lots of opportunities. Maybe then I'll become a singer.
Our profile of Christina Lampiana Rudd was produced by Tekla Perry, senior editor at Spectrum Radio, the broadcast edition of IEEE Spectrum, the magazine of technology insiders. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Okay, take care of a little business here. We want to remind you that you can listen to our program stream live at our website, here-now.org. You can always download a podcast, take us with you wherever you go. That's here-now.org. And a little heads up, tomorrow on Here and Now, the award-winning Children's Theater of Minneapolis. How do they do so well? How do they sustain when other theater groups across the country don't? That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. So, what did you do on your summer vacation? Well, there's a good chance you didn't play Dab. Dab is a game played by mountain bikers, and a group of young girls in New England played it all summer. They attended the Little Bella's Mountain Biking Summer Program in western Vermont. It wrapped up on Sunday. Sisters Leah and Sabra Davison created the camp. They ride professionally for the Trek VW Factory team, and they join us from Vermont Public Radio at Fort Ethan Allen. Hello to both of you.
Hi.
Leah, let me start with you. Why did you start this camp?
We saw a gap in participation with females in mountain biking. So we were, of course, at all these mountain biking races, and there are very few younger girls on the start line.
You were finding that they might ride with their parents when they were little, but then there's a cutoff.
Exactly. When they get to the teenage years, they gravitate more towards team-oriented sports such as soccer because they want to hang out with their friends. So we wanted to create a program to get more girls on bikes and have a team atmosphere, most importantly, so they continue on with the sport.
Well, Sabra, you know, some people might say that more girls aren't on mountain bikes, which is called an extreme sport, because girls are sane. You're talking to someone, I have to disclose here, that I am someone who came down a very big mountain in Utah on a bike saying, I will never do this again. I will never do this again. I mean, you know, we're talking about sliding on dirt, rocks, getting hit in the head with tree limbs. Why do you want girls on mountain bikes?
Well, we think it can really increase self-confidence. It's a sport where there's literally obstacles. So having girls get over these obstacles and be able to overcome personal challenges can really up their self-confidence. And that's what it gives us. So we use manageable trails to start with and then up the ante.
Well, and Leah, what does it feel like when you're doing it well and you're both, you know, going up the mountain, the exertion of energy going up and then coming down and keeping your balance? What does that feel like?
It's the most amazing feeling in the world, personally. I'm a little bit biased, but it's gratifying when you're actually riding down the trail, floating over these obstacles. We definitely still have bumps and bruises.
Well, I mean, it's a high-injury sport.
Definitely.
Yeah, it definitely is. But I think the funniest thing when people first watch pro races is that we still fall too. Everyone falls.
But obviously it's worth it to you because?
Because it's the most gratifying thing when you're, you know, going over this huge log or going down this rooty, rocky thing that looks like, you know, I don't think I can even make it down walking. You get over it, and it's a great experience. You learn a lot about yourself in this journey, and then also it's a great bonding moment. I find that all mountain bikers, you know, the racers, and in our program, the Little Bellas, really bond through that challenge.
Well, and as you teach them, tell us, what are just a couple quick tips if you're going to be taking up mountain biking? What was I doing wrong, for instance? What should we know?
Well, one thing you want to look where you want to go instead of saying, oh, I don't want to hit this rock. I don't want to run into that tree. You want to look where you want to go.
Ahead
and
of
your
where
bike will end up going there.
Huh. And I would also say if you're a female, start out with other females riding. That's why we created this all-girls program because it's a very different experience. We're more nurturing and supportive. And so, you know, it's really just based on fun and getting a healthy, active lifestyle going.
Well, before we let you go, this game of Dab that the girls play, what is that?
Dab is when you fall off your bike or just touch your foot down. And so we designed a game to prevent the girls from dabbing. And when they do dab, they have to freeze and they become an obstacle for the other girls. It's an enclosed space and they ride around until they dab. So the last girl standing wins.
So you try to get them to fall off their bikes.
Yeah, it gets pretty ruthless out there, actually. Girls are balancing and trying to T-bone each other.
T-bone?
Like, you basically are riding into each other on your bikes, but we don't allow a lot of that.
Okay, well, of course, you know, I feel like we have to say all of this is done with helmets and
definitely.
All sorts of stuff like that. That's Leah and Sabra Davison speaking to us from Vermont Public Radio. They created the weekly summer program in Vermont called Little Bellas, teaching girls to ride mountain bikes. They both ride professionally for the Trek VW Factory team and spoke to us from Vermont Public Radio and Fort Ethan Allen. You guys, thanks so much.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
I would need an ambulance following me down the mountain. Coming up, the resurrection of ragtime genius Blind Boone in 1 minute, here and now.
C Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and this music was composed more than a century ago by a man largely forgotten, although his music helped foster 20th century popular American music much later. John William Boone was an African-American pianist and composer from Missouri who caused quite a sensation in the late 1800s. He was an excellent musician, he was the son of a runaway slave, and he was blind. When Boone was just 6 months old, doctors removed his eyes and sewed his eyelids shut because of an illness. Boone later said, "I regard my blindness as a blessing, for had I not been blind, I would not have given the inspiration to the world that I have." Well, and we probably wouldn't know any of this if it weren't for our next guest. John Davis is a performer, recording artist, writer, and someone with a fascination for early blind piano players. Earlier this year, the Juilliard-trained pianist released his latest CD, Marshfield Tornado. John Davis plays Blind Boone, and John Davis joins us now. Welcome.
My pleasure to be here.
This is something that you have paid attention to, but how did you come across Blind Boone, as he's going to be called?
Well, concurrent to my study of classical music throughout my life, I became immersed in African-American music and folklore and literature from the age of 10 when my brother brought home a CD, or actually an LP, of the late great Mississippi bluesman Sonny Boy Williamson. And this led me ultimately to collect all kinds of printed 19th century African Americana, which includes books and sheet music. And I kept coming across the name of really two people, a man named Blind Boone, but actually his predecessor was a man named Blind Tom, whose music I've also recorded.
That's Improvisation on When This Cruel War Is Over. It's from your recording of Blind Tom's music. Now, he was born in 1849, 15 years before Blind Boone. Tell us more about Blind Tom.
He was a slave. He was perhaps autistic. And he was a famous child prodigy and probably the first black superstar performer in America.
Well, now, did Blind Tom, who had this, you know, huge success, did Blind Tom and Blind Boone ever meet?
Yes. In 1880, there was a celebrated playoff between Blind Tom, now already a very famous pianist, and a 15-year-old John William Boone in Columbia, Missouri. The local papers reported, and probably apocryphally, that Boone so outplayed Thomas Wiggins, which was Blind Tom's real name, that the Georgia slave pianist left town right after the concert, never to return to those parts.
So in the sort of throwdown between Blind Boone and Blind Tom, Blind Boone wins. Let's hear a little more of Blind Boone's music as you play it. This is The Hummingbird, which he wrote in 1880. John Davis, we know that Blind Boone was born in 1864 in a Union Army camp in Miami, Missouri. His mother, a former slave, his father, an unidentified white bugler for the Missouri State Militia. But with his blindness, how did he come to be trained to play?
He was sent, actually, to the St. Louis School for the Blind. One of his duties there was to make brooms in the broom department. And right next door, various students were learning to play the piano, and he became fascinated with this and started to play himself and took to it immediately. Ultimately, his real coming-out party was around 1879, 1880, just before that playoff with Blind Tom, where he got himself attached to a man named John Lang Jr., who became his manager.
Thank you.
That's Sparks Galop du Concert from Marshfield Tornado. John Davis plays Blind Boone. And John Davis, we understand that Blind Boone's manager, John Lang Jr., had a motto, merit not sympathy wins. Was that applied to Boone's blindness or his blackness?
First of all, I think it was a direct reference to Blind Tom's career. It was trying to discourage the kind of sordid attention to the star's infirmity that had been so zealously exploited by Blind Tom's handlers. They were earning huge money off of promoting him as a kind of freak show, trading upon the racial stereotypes of the era. But when Blind Boone came along, he and Lang decided that they didn't want to be promoted in that way. And in fact, it was kind of an activist impulse behind the Blind Boone Company mission.
Well, and when you talk about the merit, whether or not he was blind, he could play three songs at once, one with his right hand, one with his left, one with his voice, each in a different key. He could play back anything anyone else played. In fact, his manager, Lang, wagered a bet that he'd pay somebody $1,000 if they could play something he couldn't play back note for note from just from hearing it. He also could write beautiful music. Let's hear another original work by John William Boone as played by John Davis, Caprice de Concert, number 2. Well, John Davis, Blind Boone suffered a heart attack on October 4th, 1927. He died at age 63. Why is he so forgotten?
I think many of these early figures, and I even relate some of these early figures as precursor to the great bluesmen that came later, like Sonny Boy Williamson, who I grew up idolizing, who were all kind of marginalized by the society after they died, even though they were hugely popular figures in their day. And I think through the efforts of many people, hopefully their names will be, included in the pantheon of American musical history.
Because why?
First of all, culturally, they've been hugely important in music in America, and also the contributions of African Americans have also been not acknowledged completely. And I think there were probably lots of racial elements that went into that neglect.
That's John Davis, pianist, writer, recording artist. His most recent CD, Marshfield Tornado. John Davis plays Blind Boone. We've been talking about Blind Boone, but Marshfield Tornado, just remind us the title of the CD.
The title referred to a famous tornado in Marshfield, Missouri in 1880, and it was a piece that he intentionally never published and never recorded. It's been lost. And I decided to call the album that title because it sort of reflects the kind of neglect and the mystery behind his forgotten career.
John, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
For more on John Davis and John William Boone, or Blind Boone as he was called, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.